Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the Dawn of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second half of our dual episode season 8 finale. A couple nights ago, Adam Davies and Lori Simmons tore the house down on the first half. Tonight, we're going to go even further into the strange and unusual and, quite frankly, unsettling. Our guest tonight, I've been a fan of his since way back in March of 2012 when I first heard him talking about this issue on Coast to Coast. I was telling him before we started the show, I happened to be working that night and listening to the show and was just absolutely riveted by his material, and I've followed his stuff ever since. And he is one of the most requested guests we've had in quite some time. I get emails all the time from people who want to hear him on BOA Audio, and I wanted to have him on the show forever myself. And quite frankly, a big part of that delay is just how intimidating this research is. Not only just the sheer massive amount of content that he's produced on this mystery, but the, as I said, unsettling nature of it all. David Pilates, welcome to BOA Audio. Thank you so much, sir, for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for the invite, Tim.
Normally, I bestow a whole bunch of even more platitudes on the guests, but we only got you for an hour, and I want to squeeze as much out of you as possible here because this story is something else. First of all, to start out, we like to give folks a little bio background on the guest. Tell people, who is David Pilates, and how did you find out about what I guess we'll call the missing 411 phenomenon?
Well, earlier in life, I spent 20 years as a police officer in California. I then went on and worked in technology, primarily in HR. In the last 3 years, I was in business development. I traveled around the world doing business development for a company out of Canada. I kind of got back into the swing of investigations again when I got back home. A couple of people that did that were part of a startup company had some interesting stories about the woods, and they had me do some work on that for them at the beginning. As would have it, I was at a national park one day, and a couple of park workers were following me around. At the end of the day, I went back to my lodge and was kind of kicking back and got a knock on the door, and two guys in plain clothes were there, and they said they were National Park Service Rangers and they wanted to talk to me. They went on to tell a story that they had worked at several parks over the last 15 years and that they had kind of come together and compared notes, and they figured out that there were an abnormal amount of missing people. And they believed that at the front end, that first 7 to 10 days, there was a lot of publicity and there was a lot of people looking for someone. And then at the tail end of it, it just went away. There were no more investigations. There were no more searches. And essentially, there was no more action on the case. And they believed that it was an abnormal number of missing people, and they disappeared in unusual locations. And an abnormal number were never found. And they said, you know, someone needs to look into this. And they said, Dave, we know who you are. We know your background. You've done some good work before, so we want to kind of lay it on you. And that's kind of how it started.
And it's turned into something just absolutely breathtaking, to be honest with you. Somebody was asking me, Jeff Ritzman, my good friend, I was on his show over the summer, and he asked me who of the guests I've had, whose stuff has really blown me away. And I was like, well, you know, I don't like to pick, you know, favorite guests, because it's like picking favorite kids. But I'm like, one guy I really want to talk to is David Pilates. His stuff is outstanding, and I can't wait to talk to him. And let's do the plugs here to make sure folks know what we're talking about. Missing 411, Western United States, that was the first book. Missing 411, Eastern United States, that's the follow-up. Then Missing 411 North America and Beyond, and then the most recent one here, Missing 411, The Devil's in the Details. That's the one that I read leading up to tonight. And, of course, the website is canammissing.com. We got all that right, right?
That's correct.
And just this is something I like to do. I kind of joked about it on a previous episode. Folks, this is the sound of Missing 411, The Devil's in the Details, just hitting my desk right now. This thing's massive. This thing is like, look at it, folks. It's huge, and all of the books are like that. So it's I don't know how you kind of teased this when we were talking beforehand, setting up the interview. I don't know how you find the time to compile these cases. They just must be pouring in on you at this point.
You know, in the last couple years, it seems as though there has been an escalation of cases that match the profile we're looking at, and that is of concern. But I think the awareness of people out there to what we're doing and what we're looking for has assisted in kind of vetting the cases that are out there and getting the ones to us that really have meaning to the incident we're working. So it's hard to tell if there's been an increase in number or there's just more awareness at this point.
Right, right. Well, also, it's like you could be getting cases from the 80s and stuff like that, too. It's like this the thing spans quite the field of time. Now, to start things out, I hate to like put you on the spot right to start, but it was in the introduction to the book and it sort of piqued my interest. And you say, you know, that you don't really like to sort of go to any conclusion just yet about what this is all about. And people do appreciate that. And I appreciate that, too, because you leave it up to people to try and figure out on their own. But then you kind of tease here. You say the field of suspects is narrowing. So just to nudge you a little bit, what can you tell me about that sentence? Can you give me a little more information? You know, how big is this field or anything? Because I'm just so perplexed by this mystery, and you've clearly looked at it 1,000 times more than I have. So the field of suspects is narrowing. What does that mean?
Well, I think that the facts that are being accumulated over time tend to point, the arrow starts to get a little finer. And I think at the beginning, when you're looking at 500 cases, you know, maybe you have a very wide open view. And as you get down and, you know, you look at 4,000 or 5,000 cases, that field of focus starts to narrow a little bit. As an example, in this latest book, you know, I talked about some disappearances on the water.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, there was a mass amount of people that said, oh, you know, Politis, he's writing these books because he thinks a cryptid did it. And, you know, we know what he's doing. And I'm smart enough to realize that it may take 10,000 cases to look at to really finalize who the culprit is.
Mm.
And to come out and say, oh, yeah, I know what this is. Later on down the line, if someone is disproven, then you lose a lot of credibility. Even though at times I'm pushed to say, okay, you got to have an idea. The reality of it is I'm not going to be an idiot, and I'm not going to step up and say something that I'm not absolutely sure about.
Right, right, right. Absolutely, exactly. Now, it seemed to me, I kind of came out of this, and as I said, I've only read The Devil's in the Details. I have North America and Beyond, and I've read parts of that. So I'm not nearly as versed in this as you are. So if I ask questions sometimes that you think need clarification, definitely please enlighten me to that. It seemed like just from this book, it seemed like we have two distinct sort of types of incidents. You've got the children who are sometimes found and the adults who are almost never found. It feels like maybe we're... I think it's safe to say that we're dealing with like multiple phenomena here that are behind these disappearances. I don't think part of me just doesn't think that we can classify all these things or even, you know, like a majority of them to one specific thing. It feels like there may be multiple strange things happening, multiple possible criminal things too, obviously not just paranormal, but different sort of suspects, if you will, behind all of this.
So I think you have to keep a real broad perspective, and we came out this last year and we produced a map of the United States and Southern Canada that shows the 52 clusters of disappearances. And if you really study that map, there's a couple things that come to focus quickly. In the last book, we came out with a series of clusters around the Great Lakes that we never knew about before. So there's a focus on water. If you look at all of the clusters up and down the west coast of the U.S., they're all close to water. If you look at the clusters all up and down the East Coast, they're all close to water. but yet you look right down the middle of the United States, the furthest point from water, and there's none.
Yeah.
There's like a band right down the middle of the U.S. where there's hardly anything.
Yeah, I'm looking at the map right now. We got it on the thing. Yeah, that is creepy. And, you know, something I didn't even notice until you pointed it out, but now I'm really creeped out. And sort of in like Nevada, where it's the high desert, the sort of deserty area.
Exactly. So, but then again, you start up in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and you go down to the mountains in New Mexico, and right through that, you have to acknowledge that there's some relationship to big mountains and water. And that's kind of what it comes down to, because that string of disappearances up the East Coast almost follows the Appalachian Trail going from south to north.
Yeah. Oh, this is some spooky stuff. Now, like I said, we got you in a small window here. I feel like this is going to be the fastest Banal of America audio episode I've ever done, because I'm so into this. And leading into this, you asked me to pick some cases to talk about that stood out to me in the book. And so, you know, I know you do a lot of work looking at these leading into the show, so I don't want to, like, jump in a whole bunch of stuff and then go, oh, we never talked about the cases, because then you're going to be like, well, what did I waste my Wednesday afternoon for, Tim, you clown? So... That I got one question before we get into the cases, actually, because this is perfect to sort of lead into it from what we've been talking about so far. And that is also in the intro, you say that thanks to a diligent reader, and we should probably mention who it is, but I don't have it in front of me, but thanks to a diligent reader of the Missing 401 stuff, you guys have started to or in the process of putting together a database. And so what's the status of that, and is this ever going to be made available to the public? Because it's the kind of thing I feel like I could spend about 3 days myself just digging into.
So a engineer from Microsoft got an interest. She worked on it night and day, and she put it together. And I don't think anything on that database would be revealing to the public, because everything at the back of the books is on the database.
Hmm.
The list of the missing, the names, the ages, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that there would be a lot gleaned from that. You buy the books, you're going to find the same thing at the back of the book. I've had a lot of people say, yeah, you know, we pull those pages out at the back of the book and we post them on the wall and we look at them. Hey, perfect. I wish everyone would do that.
Right, right.
Because I think there is something there. The names, the ages, the graphs in the back of the book that you have, the devil's in the detail, the distances people travel, especially kids, seems obscene and doesn't seem possible.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the only reason why I'm asking is because, like, with some kind of computerized database, then at least you can run various types of searches on it and stuff. If you only have it in the paper form, it's hard to, like, because, like, what struck out to me was, I don't know if you noticed this, maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree, but it seemed like a lot of these cases seem to take place sort of in the first 5 days of the month or the last 5 days of the month. It seemed to me that stood out, or maybe I was just sort of projecting a pattern that I imagined, but that's the kind of thing where I was like, well, if there was a database, I could maybe do a search on that instead of having to go through an account.
I don't see that happening anytime soon, Tim.
All right. I respect your honesty. I like it. I like it. Okay, so the first case I mentioned to you in the email leading into this was the Haley Zaga case. It's from 42901 in Newton County, Arkansas. She's age 6. I won't play the spoiler here, so I guess just enlighten us to this story, and I'll follow up a little bit afterwards after you've told us it.
So this is probably the one case where mainstream media pulled it, showed some interest, and it was on a Dateline NBC segment years ago. Happened April 29, 2001, about 11:30 in the morning. Haley Zaga, 6 years old. She's with her grandparents. Before we go further, as you read my books, you'll notice that an abnormal number of kids disappear when they're with an aunt and uncle or with grandparents. Can't put it together yet, but it's really an abnormal number of kids. And they're hiking, and they're in the Buffalo Wilderness, kind of southeast of Harrison, Arkansas, going down the trail, just kind of having a good time. And Haley sees a sign, says, oh, the waterfall this direction. She wants to go to the waterfall. The grandparents say, no, let's just kind of keep moseying along the trail. Somehow or another, and this is the way it happens all the time, the grandparents lost sight of her. And they start yelling for her, searching for her, walking up and down the trail, screaming for her. They hear nothing. They get no response. So they eventually go back to the trailhead. They call the Newton County Sheriff. they respond out, and right away they fire up a big response: sheriffs, search and rescue teams, helicopters, National Guard, fire departments. They pull everything. 8 bloodhound teams come out, and none of them find anything. And the FLIR in the helicopter is up for 3 days. They see nothing that could match a person out there. Well, 51 hours after she disappears, she's found 2 miles from the point the grandparents last saw her. She's sitting in a brook with her feet in the water, and she's described as having scratches up and down her body. A couple things important about this. Many, many people are found in or near a creek, alive and deceased, and many, many of these kids have scratches up and down their body. Now, she eventually gets taken to a hospital. She's in really good condition, and she explains to her parents when they ask her what happened and what did she do and how did she get away or why didn't she respond. She says on that first night she slept on a bluff, meaning on the top of this mountain, and that puzzled the searchers because the helicopter never picked her up sleeping up there. Second night she slept in a cave, and then she just kind of throws it in. She goes, well, and along the way I kind of had some help. Parents go, well, what do you mean you had some help? And she said, well, this other girl came along and kind of helped me up and down the boulder field and kind of walk around. And they said, really? And she said, yeah, it was a little girl about my age named Alicia. And they thought, well, maybe she's dreaming this up just to have a companion. But the sheriff went back and did some research, and 23 years prior to Haley disappearing, another girl that same age disappeared in the area. And believe it or not, her name wasn't Alicia, but it was Alana. And just the innocence that Haley had and the truthfulness that everyone felt that she gave this story, they thought, wow, in her mind, it must have at least happened, and the coincidence is there.
Mm. Well, that's what really stood out to me in a couple of these cases that I brought up to you leading into all this, because it's like when we get any sort of insights from the people who manage to survive this or who go through the incident and try to communicate in the midst of it, which we'll get to a couple in a moment, those seem to stand out to me because that's the closest we might get to a glimpse of all this. Now, she was 6 in 2001, and I know later in the book, I think it was, I have in the notes here, Joan Threes. I might have the last name misspelled, but it's the question is, has anyone tried to reach out to these folks? Because there's a handful of people like this, the little girl, this Joan Threes it happened to, you know, where people reach out to them after they've made it back to find out if they can recollect any more information, you know, down the line.
So kids, this is a traumatic experience. And even for adults, when they're found, it's traumatic. And when you start researching an area, you don't want to step in the same puddles that people before you have and the same landmines and go through the same aggravation and things that people before you have gone through. So smart researchers will go to groups in that arena that they're interested in and question them about, what are the pros and cons of doing this? What should I avoid? What should I do? What should I not do?
Yeah.
So you don't learn from their mistakes. You're not just replicating the same thing.
Right.
We went to some missing persons groups, explained what we were interested in doing, asked for direction. One of the things they said was, is if you're going to write a book about the incident, I wouldn't go out and proactively contact the victims, because many of them will think that they're victimized a second time by you writing a story about their incident.
Yeah.
Now, it's different if they approach us, and that's happened, but we won't proactively contact them.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. That was a concern of mine in the general idea of that, because it's like, why, leave me alone is probably the reaction that you might get, but it's, you hope that there's some kind of recollection that you could find out later. Now, you also say in the book, if you're ever able to find photos of these kids after they've been found, their eyes are all, they seem agog. But I didn't see any in the book. Are they in the other books, or like, have you seen these photos and describe them a little bit? Because that sounded kind of really creepy.
There are photos in other books of the kids, and many of them that we've seen are in newspapers and are copyrighted, and we can't replicate them. But the ones we did replicate, just imagine the kids' eyes being as open as they could be open and this sort of blank stare that they have looking out. It's definitely identifiable.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Now, the next case is along the same lines. I'm kind of skipping amongst the ones that I sent to you, and that's the Cullen-Finnerty one. It's actually one of the highlighted cases in the book. It's 5/26/2013 from Weber Township, Michigan. And again, it's another case where we get a glimpse into whatever is unfolding in this mystery window here, a brief glimpse, but it's fascinating and really compelling. So share this story, please.
So I think this is a very revealing case for a multitude of reasons. Is you have a victim that's communicating with his wife while the incident is unveiled. And Cullen, 6'2", 240 pounds, quarterback in college football, played for Grand Valley State, set a 28-0 record. He was probably a stud amongst all studs as far as a quarterback. He played a full game with a broken collarbone one time. He told his lineman at one point early in his career, they were beating on one of the opposing players who came through and hit Cullen. And Cullen said, "Hey, don't worry about it. Let him hit me. It won't hurt me." And he goes, "I like him to hit me." And his coach thought he was nuts. But that's how tough the guy was. In 2007, he signed with the Baltimore Ravens, briefly played for the Broncos. He ended up marrying a volleyball player from his school, Jennifer. They have a couple kids. Well, on Memorial Day weekend 2013, his wife's family decided they wanted to go near the Baldwin River in this area of Weber Township in Michigan. Right away when I saw this name, it keyed on me because I've written stories about two other disappearances in this same area during the last 90 years that are some of the most unusual disappearances you can think of. And therein lies the reason I think that we study history, is because if a certain area has a replication of disappearances on the strange side, you kind of put that under some radar. Well, Cullen was with his wife, his kids. They were staying in a rented cabin on a lake. Had a great 3 days. It was a Memorial Day weekend. And on the last day, May 26th, late in the afternoon, Cullen said to the family, "Hey, I had such a good time. I just want to go one more time down the river fishing." And they said, "Great, fine." So a little after 8 o'clock, the family dropped him off in his boat on the river. And 45 minutes after they drop him off, his wife receives a call from him, and she described it as a frantic call, saying that he was being followed by one or two people. They were 20 feet behind him. He tried to talk to him, but they wouldn't talk to him. And he says, this is the part that's pretty baffling. He says, "I'm getting out of the river, and I'm taking off my clothes," and the phone hung up. Now, what's key to this is that many, many of the incidents I've written about, the people are found missing clothes. Now, why would Cullen, if he's being followed by somebody, take the time to remove his clothes?
Yeah.
So what he was wearing, he was wearing fishing waders, suspenders, and a long sleeve shirt. And his wife received other calls like 8 or 9 minutes later, still being followed, felt nervous, got to go, out of breath, and anxious. And again, all very strange because there wasn't a lot there. This area is a really, really thick wooded area. The river's not huge, just big enough to get a small raft in it. Well, the last time Jennifer talks to him, she says, "Hey, Cullen, take a second. Give me the coordinates off your iPhone so we know where you're at." And he rattles them off. Well, that was the last time that they heard of him, and he just stopped calling. They showed up at the point where he was supposed to come out. He wasn't there, and they called the sheriff. Now, this is a small rural county, but these guys were on it, and they did the right thing. First deputy there called the cell phone provider and said, "Hey, ping the phone and give me the coordinates of where those pings come back to." And this is the part that's very, very revealing. During that time, and in the short time that they were pinging the phone, they got four locations 4.37 miles apart from each other, which would be essentially impossible under conventional thinking, because to get to the locations where the phone was pinged, he would have had to have crossed three or four streets, meaning it would have been impossible for him to be lost. And at about 13 minutes past midnight, the family found his boat. One oar was missing out of the boat. And that was May 27th, real early in the morning. The day, May 27th, was a very rainy day, cloudy skies. Again, pertinent to what we write about, because bad weather is involved in the majority of these disappearances, either as they occur or immediately after. 100 volunteers, dogs, deputies, they did everything they could to find them. They searched. And many of the searchers and the relatives couldn't believe he'd be lost, because this area was not an easy place to get lost in. It's very flat. Again, a lot of streets. There's a city right nearby. Very strange. And there was talk that some people thought Cullen must have been abducted. Now, what's funny about Coach over at Grand Valley State said, anybody taking on Cullen Finnerty would have to be insane, because that's not going to happen. They said there's no way someone's going to take him. He'd take on an army.
Yeah.
Well, on May 28th, at about 8 p.m., Cullen was found face down. Another important point in our descriptions of people that are found, they're found face down, unusual. One arm was under him, one arm was extended. And interesting to me is when I looked at the crime scene photos, he was wearing suspenders that were crossed on his back, and the suspenders were turned several times. And anybody who's a fisherman knows you would never wear your suspenders like that. It's uncomfortable. And it almost looked like somebody had grabbed him, to me, from the suspenders to cause this turning motion on the suspender. It was strange.
Yeah.
Well, in the case folder, there was a lot of things. Most of the things I just told you here, the New York Times wrote a giant article about this. It went to Kent County pathologists, and they said that there were no obvious signs of death. There were some unusual things about what they found, but nothing that pointed to a direct cause of death. Then, I got to respect these guys, because they then sent his body to Boston University's medical team for a secondary look at what caused his death. And they again stated that they couldn't find a definitive cause. There were some interesting things that wouldn't really relate to him being missing, but they said he didn't have a heart attack, and they couldn't figure out exactly why.
Jeez.
Again, an important part, because many of the people that are found, doctors say they can't figure out why they died. Now, the important points in this study is how he got from his boat to where his body was found to where the cell phones were being pinged.
Right, right.
And logically, it couldn't have happened that way, unless there's something happening that we completely don't understand.
I think we've David, I think we've established through the series of four books that there is something here that we completely do not understand going on. That is why so many people are riveted by this phenomenon. It is, you know, I'm sitting here. There's a part of me, and I'm sure you. Well, you used to be a detective. I mean, I'm sure you. This is kind of second nature to you. But part of me, as I'm reading these cases, I'm sort of like throwing out these scenarios in my mind. Well, maybe it was this. Maybe it was that. Maybe, you know. I don't want to do that to you, because it's like we don't know the answer to these questions. It's baffling that with that case we have sort of a timeline of events through the phone pings. And the boat being found, the body being found. I don't really know what to make of that one at all.
Well, it is interesting that he tells his wife that he's being followed.
Right.
By two guys. That's what he says. And he says he yells at them, but they don't respond. So, you know, in my mind, I tend to think, well, what could have been following him that, you know, it was dark out. It was very dark at that point. And maybe he misinterpreted something for being two guys. Or maybe there's something unusual going on out there and we don't get it.
Right, right. The nature of the pings and the boat and the body, is it like physically impossible for him to have made this journey without some kind of, like on foot, essentially?
Yes.
Okay. See, then we get, yeah. So then we're not talking about, like, he went crazy and started running around. It's like, no, folks, that's not possible. So, you know, I'm just completely baffled. I want to stay on the path of strange phone calls and also additional sort of strange patterns that seem to be happening in these cases. And two of those things come together here in the Megumi Yamamoto case from June 9th, 2011, Mount Baldy, New Mexico. Not only are there phone calls during this disappearance and a whole series of strange, malfunctions, let's say, on the 911 call system, which makes it even more bizarre and troubling, but then also a helicopter crash, which ties into a whole series of patterns involving aircraft crashes during these disappearances. So two strange patterns come together here on the Megumi Yamamoto case. So let's hear about that one, David.
So Megumi is a grad student at University of New Mexico in physics. She's a nanotechnology expert trying to work on that angle and that in optics. She's 26 years old, a graduate of the University of California at Long Beach. She is a Japanese national going to school here. She had a boyfriend, Paul Harrington, and her and Paul went camping, and they went into the Pecos Wilderness. It's another one of those locations where I've written about two other cases where people disappeared under highly unusual circumstances. So this one really caught my interest right away. So they went up into the wilderness, they're hiking in a trail, and a wilderness means that you can't bring any cars, bikes, you can only bring a horse into it. You got to travel on foot or on horseback. Her and Paul were hiking along, and again, somehow, some way, they got separated. Well, Megumi was smart. She had her cell phone with her, and after a little bit of hiking and trying to find her way out, she couldn't. She calls 911. And it goes into the local sheriff's department, and she says, hey, I'm lost somewhere in the Pecos Wilderness, and I need help. And they said, okay, well, you need to call back on 911. And she goes, I did call in on 911. And they go, well, if you call in on 911, we'll be able to triangulate your position and have people come rescue you. No, I did call on 911. Okay, hang up and call again on 911 then. She did this seven times. Seven times the call got redirected to a non-emergency line, meaning that the sheriff's department couldn't triangulate and couldn't find her. This had never happened before in the sheriff's department history and hasn't happened since. The eighth time she calls, it goes through to 911 and they triangulate it and they start sending search and rescue people out. Now you talk about a coincidence of bad, I don't know what you'd call it, just bad luck.
Yeah.
There's nothing more that could have gone wrong on this, and it started with the calls. That followed up, search and rescue teams went out, and right away the weather starts to get bad. It clouds in and it starts to snow. Unbelievably, some of the search and rescue guys refused to even go out on their assignments because the weather was so bad. Finally, they find a couple guys who say, okay, go out. And right away, way out in the wilderness, they triangulate with GPS and they find her. So they call for a state police helicopter to come in and rescue her. Well, now they have to go to the feds, and they have to get approval to land a helicopter in the wilderness in an emergency, if you can believe this. So that delayed them some more, but they get the approval. New Mexico State Police send out a helicopter. Sergeant Andy Tingwall and spotter is Officer Wes Cox fly out. And they're very high up. They're flying into the area. He lands on one skid. Megumi gets in. As the helicopter's taking off, some people say there was a gust of wind. Some people say there was nothing. The helicopter rotates slightly. It hits a tree, and it crashes 800 feet down the side of Mount Baldy. It kills Megumi. It kills the pilot, and the spotter lives. And if you look at this incident and you say, okay, what are the commonalities here with what we've known in the past? Five physicists or physicist majors in school I've written about who have disappeared momentarily or permanently in the wilderness or never came out of the wilderness. There's five crashes involving aircraft in conjunction with cases I've written about. And if you think about this case specifically, I don't know of one case where so many things went wrong. And I thought about it later on and I was writing up the incident. And I thought, you know what? There was no way she was going to get out of there alive.
Yeah. it's like almost, it makes you wonder if it's like that movie where all the people get away from the plane crash and then they die in different ways right away. It's like, is she just destiny or what? It's really spooky stuff.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?